I had been expecting a hilltop castle of forbidding grey stone, with barred windows and iron-bound oak doors. But this was a Bavarian country house, with steep, overhanging roofs, wooden balconies, and a little bell tower. Surely nothing as horrible as child murder could go on here. It also seemed small for a hospital. Then she saw that a modern extension had been added to one side, with a tall chimney. They dismounted and leaned their bikes against the side of the building. Carla's heart was in her mouth as they walked up the steps to the entrance. Why were there no guards? Because no one would be so foolhardy as to try to investigate the place? There was no bell or knocker, but when Carla pushed the door, it opened. She stepped inside, and Frida followed. They found themselves in a cool hall with a stone floor and bare white walls. There were several rooms off the hall, but all the doors were closed. A middle-aged woman in spectacles was coming down a broad staircase. She wore a smart, grey dress.
"Yes," she said.
"Hello,"
said Frida casually.
"What are you doing? You can't come in here."
Frida and Carla had prepared a story.
"I just wanted to visit the place where my brother died," Frida said. "He was 15.
"This isn't a public facility,"
the woman said indignantly.
"Yes, it is."
Frida had been brought up in a wealthy family, and was not cowed by minor functionaries. A nurse of about 19 appeared from a side door and stared at them. The woman in the grey dress spoke to her.
"Nurse Koenig, fetch Herr Römer immediately."
The nurse hurried away. The woman said,
"You should have written in advance."
"Did you not get my letter?" said Frida. "I wrote to the senior physician."
This was not true. Frida was improvising.
"No such letter has been received."
Clearly the woman felt that Frida's outrageous request could not possibly have gone unnoticed. Carla was listening. The place was strangely quiet. She had dealt with physically and mentally handicapped people, adults and children, and they were not often silent. Even through these closed doors, she should have been able to hear shouts, laughter, crying, voices raised in protest, and nonsensical ravings. But there was nothing. It was more like a morgue. Frida tried a new tack.
"Perhaps you can tell me where my brother's grave is. I'd like to visit it."
"There are no graves. We have an incinerator."
She immediately corrected herself.
"A cremation facility."
Carla said,
"I noticed the chimney."
Frida said,
"What happened to my brother's ashes?"
"They will be sent to you in due course.
Don't mix them up with anyone else's, will you?"
The woman's neck reddened in a blush, and Carla guessed they did mix up the ashes, figuring that no one would know. Nurse Koenig reappeared, followed by a burly man in the white uniform of a male nurse. The woman said,
"Ah, Römer, please escort these girls off the premises."
"Just a minute," said Frida. "Are you quite sure you're doing the right thing? I only wanted to see the place where my brother died."
"Quite sure."
"Then you won't mind letting me know your name?"
There was a second's hesitation.
"Frau Schmidt, now please leave us."
Römer moved toward them in a menacing way.
"We're going,"
Frida said frostily. "We have no intention of giving Herr Römer an excuse to molest us." The man changed course and opened the door for them. They went out, climbed on their bikes, and rode down the drive. Frida said,
"Do you think she believed our story?"
"Totally,"
said Carla. "She didn't even ask our names. If she had suspected the truth, she would have called the police right away."
"But we didn't learn much. We saw the chimney,
but we didn't find anything we could call proof."
Carla felt a bit down. Getting evidence was not as easy as it sounded. They returned to the hostel. They washed and changed and went out in search of something to eat. The only cafe was the one with the grumpy proprietress. They ate potato pancakes with sausage. Afterward, they went to the town's bar. They ordered beers and spoke cheerfully to the other customers, but no one wanted to talk to them. This in itself was suspicious. People everywhere were wary of strangers, for anyone might be a Nazi snitch. But even so, Carla wondered how many towns there were where two young girls could spend an hour in a bar without anyone even trying to flirt with them. They returned to the hostel for an early night. Carla could not think what else to do. Tomorrow they would return home empty-handed. It seemed incredible that she should know about these awful killings yet be unable to stop them. She felt so frustrated she wanted to scream. It occurred to her that Frau Schmidt, if that really was her name, might have further thoughts about her visitors. At the time, she had taken Carla and Frida for what they claimed to be, but she might develop suspicions later and call the police just to be safe. If that happened, Carla and Frida would not be hard to find. There were just 5 people at the hostel tonight, and they were the only girls. She listened in fear for the fatal knock on the door. If they were questioned, they would tell part of the truth, saying that Frida's brother and Carla's godson had died at Ackelberg, and they wanted to visit their graves, or at least see the place where they died and spend a few minutes in remembrance. The local police might buy that story, but if they checked with Berlin, they would swiftly learn the connection with Walter von Ulrich and Werner Frank, 2 men who had been investigated by the Gestapo for asking disloyal questions about Ackelberg. Then Carla and Frida would be deep in trouble. As they were getting ready to go to bed in the uncomfortable-looking bunks, there was a knock at the door. Carla's heart stopped. She thought of what the Gestapo had done to her father. She knew she could not withstand torture. In 2 minutes, she would name every swing kid she knew. Frida, who was less imaginative, said, "Don't look so scared," and opened the door. It was not the Gestapo, but a small, pretty blonde girl. It took Carla a moment to recognize her as Nurse Koenig, out of uniform. "I have to speak to you," she said. She was distressed, breathless and tearful. Frida invited her in. She sat on a bunk bed and wiped her eyes on the sleeve of her dress. Then she said, "I can't keep it inside any longer." Carla glanced at Frida. They were thinking the same thing. Carla said, "Keep what inside, Nurse Koenig? My name is Ilse. I'm Carla, and this is Frida. What's on your mind, Ilse?" Ilse spoke in a voice so low they could hardly hear her. She said, "We kill them." Carla could hardly breathe. She managed to say, "At the hospital?" Ilse nodded. "The poor people who come in on the grey buses. Children, even babies, and old people. Grandmothers. They're all more or less helpless. Sometimes they're horrid, dribbling and soiling themselves, but they can't help it. And some of them are really sweet and innocent. It makes no difference. We kill them all." "How do you do it?" "An injection of morphium scopolamine." Carla nodded. It was a common anesthetic, fatal in overdose. "What about the special treatments they're supposed to have?" Ilse shook her head. "There are no special treatments." Carla said, "Ilse, let me get this clear. Do they kill every patient that comes here?"
"Everyone."
"As soon as they arrive?
Within a day? No more than 2.
It was what Carla had suspected, but even so, the stark reality was horrifying, and she felt nauseated. After a minute, she said, "Are there any patients there now?"
"Not alive.
We were giving injections this afternoon. That's why Frau Schmidt was so frightened when you walked in.
Why don't they make it harder for strangers to get into the building?
They think guards and barbed wire around the hospital would make it obvious that something sinister was going on. Anyway, no one ever tried to visit before you.
How many people died today?"
52.
Carla's skin crawled. "The hospital killed 52 people this afternoon, around the time we were there."
"Yes."
"So they're all dead now?" Ilse nodded. An intention had been germinating in Carla's mind, and now she resolved to carry it out. "I want to see," she said. Ilse looked frightened.
"What do you mean?"
"I want to go inside the hospital and see those corpses."
"They're burning them already."
"Then I want to see that. Can you sneak us in?"
"Tonight?"
"Right now."
"Oh, God."
Carla said, "You don't have to do anything. You've already been brave, just by talking to us. If you don't want to do any more, it's okay. But if we're going to put a stop to this, we need proof."
"Proof?"
"Yes. Look, the government is ashamed of this project. That's why it's secret. The Nazis know that ordinary Germans won't tolerate the killing of children. But people prefer to believe it's not happening, and it's easy for them to dismiss a rumor, especially if they hear it from a young girl. So we have to prove it to them."
"I see."
Ilse's pretty face took on a look of grim determination.
"All right, then. I'll take you."
Carla stood up.
"How do you normally get there?" "Bicycle. It's outside."
"Then we'll all ride." They went out. Darkness had fallen. The sky was partly cloudy and the starlight was faint. They used their cycle lights as they rode out of town and up the hill. When they came in sight of the hospital, they switched off their lights and continued on foot, pushing their bikes. Ilsa took them by a forest path that led to the rear of the building. Carla smelled an unpleasant odor, somewhat like a car's exhaust. She sniffed. Ilsa whispered,
"The incinerator?"
"Oh, no." They hid the bikes in a shrubbery and walked silently to the back door. It was unlocked. They went in. The corridors were bright. There were no shadowy corners. The place was lit like the hospital it pretended to be. If they met someone, they would be seen clearly. Their clothes would give them away immediately as intruders. What would they do then? Run, probably. Ilsa walked quickly along a corridor, turned a corner and opened a door.
"In here,"
she whispered. They walked in. Frida let out a squeal of horror and covered her mouth. Carla whispered,
"Oh, my soul."
In a large, cold room were about 30 dead people, all lying face up on tables, naked. Some were fat, some thin, some old and withered, some children, and one a baby of about a year. A few were bent and twisted, but most appeared physically normal. Each one had a small adhesive bandage on the upper left arm, where the needle had gone in. Carla heard Frida crying softly. She steeled her nerves.
"Where are the others?"
she whispered.
"Already gone to the furnace,"
Ilsa replied. They heard voices coming from behind the double door at the far end of the room.
"Back outside,"
Ilsa said. They stepped into the corridor. Carla closed the door all but a crack and peeped through. She saw Herr Römer and another man push a hospital trolley through the doors. The men did not look in Carla's direction. They were arguing about soccer. She heard Römer say,
"It's only 9 years ago that we won the national championship. We beat Eintracht Frankfurt 2-0. "Yes, but half your best players were Jews, and they've all gone."
Carla realized they were talking about the Bayern Munich team. Römer said,
"The old days will come back, if only we play the right tactics."
Still arguing, the two men went to a table where a fat woman lay dead. They took her by the shoulders and knees, then unceremoniously swung her onto the trolley, grunting with the effort. They moved the trolley to another table and put a second corpse on top of the first. When they had three, they wheeled the trolley out. Carla said,
"I'm going to follow them."
She crossed the morgue to the double doors, and Frida and Ilsa followed her. They passed into an area that felt more industrial than medical. The walls were painted brown, the floor was concrete, and there were store cupboards and tool racks. They looked around a corner. They saw a large room like a garage, with harsh lighting and deep shadows. The atmosphere was warm, and there was a faint smell of cooking. In the middle of the space was a steel box large enough to hold a motor car. A metal canopy led from the top of the box through the roof. Carla realized she was looking at a furnace. The two men lifted a body off the trolley and shifted it to a steel conveyor belt. Römer pushed a button on the wall. The belt moved, a door opened, and the corpse passed into the furnace. They put the next corpse on the belt. Carla had seen enough. She turned and motioned the others back. Frida bumped into Ilsa, who let out an involuntary cry. They all froze. They heard Römer say,
"What was that?"
"A ghost,"
the other replied. Römer's voice was shaky.
"Don't joke about such things. Are you going to pick up the other end of this stiff or what?"
"All right, all right."
The three girls hurried back to the morgue. Seeing the remaining bodies, Carla suffered a wave of grief about Ada's Kurt. He had lain here, with an adhesive bandage on his arm, and had been thrown onto the conveyor belt and disposed of like a bag of garbage.
"But you're not forgotten, Kurt,"
she thought. They went out into the corridor. As they turned toward the back door, they heard footsteps and the voice of Frau Schmidt.
"What is taking those two men so long?"
They hurried along the corridor and through the door. The moon was out, and the park was brightly lit. Carla could see the shrubbery where they had hidden the bikes, 200 yards away across the grass. Frida came out last, and in her rush, she let the door bang. Carla thought fast. Frau Schmidt was likely to investigate the noise. The three girls might not reach the shrubbery before she opened the door. They had to hide.
"This way,"
Carla hissed, and she ran around the corner of the building. The others followed. They flattened themselves against the wall. Carla heard the door open. She held her breath. There was a long pause. Then Frau Schmidt muttered something unintelligible, and the door banged again. Carla peeped around the corner. Frau Schmidt had gone. The three girls ran across the lawn and retrieved their bicycles. They pushed the bikes along the forest path and emerged onto the road. They switched on their lights, mounted up, and pedaled away. Carla felt euphoric. They had got away with it. As they approached the town, triumph gave way to more practical considerations. What had they achieved, exactly? What would they do next? They must tell someone what they had seen. She was not sure who. In any event, they had to convince someone. Would they be believed? The more she thought about it, the less sure she was. When they reached the hostel and dismounted, Ilse said, "Thank goodness that's over. I've never been so scared in all my life." "It's not over," said Carla.
"What do you mean?"
"It won't be over until we've closed that hospital and any others like it."
"How can you do that?"
"We need you," Carla said to her. "You're the proof."
"I was afraid you were going to say that."
"Will you come with us tomorrow, when we go back to Berlin?" There was a long pause. Then Ilse said,
"Yes, I will."
10. Volodya Peshkov was glad to be home. Moscow was at its summery best, sunny and warm. On Monday, June 30th, he returned to Red Army Intelligence Headquarters beside the Khudinka airfield. Both Werner Frank and the Tokyo spy had been right. Germany had invaded the Soviet Union on June 22nd. Volodya and all the personnel at the Soviet embassy in Berlin had returned to Moscow by ship and train. Volodya had been prioritized and made it back faster than most. Some were still traveling. Volodya now realized how much Berlin had been getting him down. The Nazis were tedious in their self-righteousness and triumphalism. They were like a winning soccer team at the aftermatch party, getting drunker and more boring and refusing to go home. He was sick of them. Some people might say that the USSR was similar, with its secret police, its rigid orthodoxy, and its Puritan attitudes to such pleasures as abstract painting and fashion. They were wrong. Communism was a work in progress, with mistakes being made on the road to a fair society. The NKVD, with its torture chambers, was an aberration, a cancer in the body of communism. One day it would be surgically removed, but probably not in wartime. Anticipating the outbreak of war, Volodya had long ago equipped his Berlin spies with clandestine radios and codebooks. Now it was more vital than ever that the handful of brave anti-Nazis should continue to pass information to the Soviets. Before leaving, he had destroyed all records of their names and addresses, which now existed only in his head. He had found both his parents fit and well, although his father looked harassed. It was his responsibility to prepare Moscow for air raids. Volodya had gone to see his sister Anya, her husband Ilya Dvorkin, and the twins, now 18 months old. Dmitri, called Dimka, and Tatiana, called Tanya. Unfortunately, their father struck Volodya as being just as rat-like and contemptible as ever. After a pleasant day at home and a good night's sleep in his old room, he was ready to start work again. He passed through the metal detector at the entrance to the intelligence building. The familiar corridors and staircases touched a nostalgic chord, even if they were drab and utilitarian. Walking through the building, he half expected people to come up and congratulate him. Many of them must have known he had been the one to confirm Barbarossa, but no one did. Perhaps they were being discreet. He entered a large open area of typists and file clerks and spoke to the middle-aged woman receptionist.
"Hello, Nika. Are you still here?"
"Good morning, Captain Peshkov," she said, not as warmly as he might have hoped.
"Colonel Lemitov would like to see you right away."
Like Volodya's father, Lemitov had not been important enough to suffer in the great purge of the late 30s, and now he had been promoted to fill the place of an unlucky former superior. Volodya did not know much about the purge, but he found it hard to believe that so many senior men had been disloyal enough to merit such punishment. Not that Volodya knew exactly what the punishment was. They could be in exile in Siberia, or in prison somewhere, or dead,
All he knew was that they had vanished. Nika added, "He has the big office at the end of the main corridor now."
Volodya walked through the open room, nodding and smiling at one or two acquaintances. But again he got the feeling that he was not the hero he had expected to be. He tapped on Lomitov's door, hoping the boss might shed some light.
"Come in."
Volodya entered, saluted, and closed the door behind him.
"Welcome back, Captain."
Lomitov came around his desk.
"Between you and me, you did a great job in Berlin."
"Thank you."
"I'm honored, sir,"
said Volodya.
"But why is this between you and me?"
"Because you contradicted Stalin."
He held up a hand to forestall protest.
"Stalin doesn't know it was you, of course. But all the same, people around here are nervous, after the purge, of associating with anyone who takes the wrong line."
"What should I have done?"
Volodya said incredulously.
"Faked wrong intelligence?"
Lomitov shook his head emphatically.
"You did exactly the right thing, don't get me wrong, and I've protected you. But just don't expect people around here to treat you like a champion."
"Okay,"
said Volodya.
Things were worse than he had imagined.
"You have your own office now, at least. 3 doors down. You'll need to spend a day or so catching up."
Volodya took that for dismissal.
"Yes, sir,"
he said. He saluted and left. His office was not luxurious, a small room with no carpet, but he had it to himself. He was out of touch with the progress of the German invasion, having been busy trying to get home as fast as possible. Now he put his disappointment aside and began to read the reports of the battlefield commanders for the first week of the war. As he did so, he became more and more desolate. The invasion had taken the Red Army by surprise. It seemed impossible, but the evidence covered his desk. On June 22nd, when the Germans attacked, many forward units of the Red Army had had no live ammunition. That was not all. Planes had been lined up neatly on airstrips, with no camouflage, and the Luftwaffe had destroyed 1,200 Soviet aircraft in the first few hours of the war. Army units had been thrown at the advancing Germans without adequate weapons, with no air cover, and lacking intelligence about enemy positions, and in consequence had been annihilated. Worst of all, Stalin's standing order to the Red Army was that retreat was forbidden. Every unit had to fight to the last man, and officers were expected to shoot themselves to avoid capture. Troops were never allowed to regroup at a new, stronger defensive position. This meant that every defeat turned into a massacre. Consequently, the Red Army was hemorrhaging men and equipment. The warning from the Tokyo spy, and Werner Frank's confirmation, had been ignored by Stalin. Even when the attack began, Stalin had at first insisted it was a limited act of provocation, done by German army officers without the knowledge of Hitler, who would put a stop to it as soon as he found out. By the time it became undeniable that it was not a provocation, but the largest invasion in the history of warfare, the Germans had overwhelmed the Soviets' forward positions. After a week, they had pushed 300 miles inside Soviet territory. It was a catastrophe. But what made Volodya want to scream out loud was that it could have been avoided. There was no doubt whose fault it was. The Soviet Union was an autocracy. Only one person made the decisions, Joseph Stalin. He had been stubbornly, stupidly, disastrously wrong, and now his country was in mortal danger. Until now, Volodya had believed that Soviet communism was the true ideology, marred only by the excesses of the secret police, the NKVD. Now he saw that the failure was at the very top. Beria and the NKVD existed only because Stalin permitted them. It was Stalin who was preventing the march to true communism. Late that afternoon, as Volodya was staring out of the window over the sunlit airstrip, brooding over what he had learned, he was visited by Kamen. They had been lieutenants together 4 years ago, fresh out of the Military Intelligence Academy, and had shared a room with two others. In those days, Kamen had been the clown, making fun of everyone, daringly mocking pious Soviet orthodoxy. Now he was heavier and seemed more serious. He had grown a small black mustache like that of the foreign minister, Molotov, perhaps to make himself look more mature. Kamen closed the door behind him and sat down. He took from his pocket a toy, a tin soldier with a key in its back. He wound up the key and placed the toy on Volodya's desk. The soldier swung his arms as if marching, and the clockwork mechanism made a loud ratcheting sound as it wound down. In a lowered voice, Kamen said, "Stalin has not been seen for 2 days." Volodya realized that the clockwork soldier was there to swamp any listening device that might be hidden in his office. He said, "What do you mean, he hasn't been seen? He has not come to the Kremlin, and he is not answering the phone." Volodya was baffled. The leader of a nation could not just disappear. What's he doing? No one knows. The soldier ran down. Kamen wound it up and set it going again. On Saturday night, when he heard that the Soviet Western Army group had been encircled by the Germans, he said, "Everything's lost. I give up. Lenin founded our state, and we've fucked it up." Then he went to Kuntsevo. Stalin had a country house near the town of Kuntsevo on the outskirts of Moscow. Yesterday he didn't show up at the Kremlin at his usual time of midday. When they phoned Kuntsevo, no one answered. Today, the same. Volodya leaned forward. "Is he suffering?" His voice fell to a whisper. "A mental breakdown?" Kamen made a helpless gesture. "It wouldn't be surprising. He insisted, against all the evidence, that Germany would not attack us. And now look." Volodya nodded. It made sense. Stalin had allowed himself to be officially called father, teacher, great leader, transformer of nature, great helmsman, genius of mankind, the greatest genius of all times and peoples. But now it had been proved, even to him, that he had been wrong and everyone else right. Men committed suicide in such circumstances. The crisis was even worse than Volodya had thought. Not only was the Soviet Union under attack and losing, it was also leaderless. This had to be its most perilous moment since the revolution. But was it also an opportunity? Could it be a chance to get rid of Stalin? The last time Stalin had appeared vulnerable was in 1924, when Lenin's testament had said that Stalin was not fit to hold power. Since Stalin had survived that crisis, his power had seemed unassailable, even, Volodya could now see clearly, when his decisions had verged on madness, the purges, the blunders in Spain, the appointment of the sadist Beria as head of the secret police, the pact with Hitler. Was this emergency the occasion, at last, to break his hold? Volodya hid his excitement from Kamen and everyone else. He hugged his thoughts to himself as he rode the bus home through the soft light of a summer evening. His journey was delayed by a slow-moving convoy of lorries towing anti-aircraft guns, presumably being deployed by his father, who was in charge of Moscow's air raid defenses. Could Stalin be deposed? He wondered how many Kremlin insiders were asking themselves the same question. He entered his parents' apartment building, the 10-story government house, across the Moskva River from the Kremlin. They were out, but his sister was there with the twins, Dimka and Tanya. The boy, Dimka, had dark eyes and hair. He held a red pencil and was scribbling messily on an old newspaper. The girl had the same intense blue-eyed stare that Grigori had, and so did Volodya, people said. She immediately showed Volodya her doll. Also there was Zoya Vorotsintsev, the astonishingly beautiful physicist Volodya had last seen 4 years earlier when he was about to leave for Spain. She and Anya had discovered a shared interest in Russian folk music. They went to recitals together, and Zoya played the gudok, a three-stringed fiddle. Neither could afford a phonograph, but Grigori had one, and they were listening to a record of a balalaika orchestra. Grigori was not a great music lover, but he thought the record sounded jolly. Zoya was wearing a short-sleeved summer dress, the pale color of her blue eyes. When Volodya asked her the conventional question about how she was, she replied sharply, "I'm very angry." There were lots of reasons for Russians to be angry just now. Volodya asked, "Why is that?" "My research into nuclear physics has been cancelled. All the scientists I work with have been reassigned. I myself am working on improvements to the design of bomb sites." That seemed very reasonable to Volodya. "We are at war, after all." "You don't understand," she said. "Listen, when uranium metal undergoes a process called fission, enormous quantities of energy are released. I mean, enormous. We know this.
and Western scientists do too. We have read their papers in scientific journals. Still, the question of bomb sites seems more immediate. Zoya said angrily, "This process, fission, could be used to create bombs that would be 100 times more powerful than anything anyone has now. One nuclear explosion could flatten Moscow. What if the Germans make such a bomb and we don't have it? It will be as if they had rifles and we only had swords." Volodya said skeptically, "But is there any reason to believe that scientists in other countries are working on a fission bomb?"
"We're sure they are. The concept of fission leads automatically to the idea of a bomb."
"We thought of it. Why shouldn't they? But there's another reason. They published all their early results in the journals. And then they stopped. Suddenly, 1 year ago. There have been no new scientific papers on fission since this time last year. And do you believe the politicians and generals in the West realize the military potential of the research and made it secret?"
"I can't think of another reason.
And yet, here in the Soviet Union, we have not even begun to prospect for uranium." Volodya was pretending to be doubtful, but in truth he found it all too credible. Even Stalin's greatest admirers, a group that included Volodya's father, Grigory, did not claim he understood science, and it was all too easy for an autocrat to ignore anything that made him uncomfortable.
"I've told your father,"
Zoya went on. "He listens to me, but no one listens to him. So what are you going to do?"
"What can I do? I'm going to make a damn good bomb site for our airmen and hope for the best."
Volodya nodded. He liked that attitude. He liked this girl. She was smart and feisty and a joy to look at. He wondered if she would go to a movie with him. Talk of physics reminded him of Willy Frunzer, who had been his friend at the Berlin Boys' Academy. According to Werner Frank, Willy was a brilliant physicist, now studying in England. He might know something about the fission bomb Zoya was so exercised about, and if he was still a communist, he might be willing to tell what he knew. Volodya made a mental note to send a cable to the Red Army intelligence desk in the London embassy. His parents came in. Father was in full dress uniform, mother in a coat and hat. They had been to one of the many interminable ceremonies the army loved. Stalin insisted such rituals continue, despite the German invasion, because they were so good for morale. They cooed over the twins for a few minutes, but father looked distracted. He muttered something about a phone call and went immediately to his study. Mother began to make supper. The lodger talked to the three women in the kitchen, but he was desperate to speak to his father. He thought he could guess the subject of father's urgent phone call. The overthrow of Stalin was being either planned or prevented right now, probably here in this building. After a few minutes, he decided to risk the old man's wrath and interrupt him. He excused himself and went to the study. But his father was just coming out.
"I have to go to Kuntsevo," he said.
Volodya longed to know what was going on.
"Why?"
he said.
Grigory ignored the question. "I've called down for my car, but my chauffeur has gone home. You can drive me."
Volodya was thrilled. He had never been to Stalin's dacha. Now he was going there at a moment of profound crisis.
"Come on,"
his father said impatiently. They shouted goodbyes from the hallway and went out. Grigory's car was a black ZIS-101A, a Soviet copy of an American Packard, with 3-speed automatic transmission. Its top speed was about 80 miles per hour. Volodya got behind the wheel and pulled away. He drove through the Arbat, a neighborhood of craftsmen and intellectuals, and out onto the westward Mozhaisk Highway.
"Have you been summoned by Comrade Stalin?" he asked his father.
"No. Stalin has been incommunicado for 2 days."
"That's what I heard."
"Did you? It's supposed to be secret."
"You can't keep something like that secret. What's happening now?"
"A group of us are going to Kuntsevo to see him."
Volodya asked the key question.
"For what purpose?"
"Primarily to find out whether he's alive or dead."
Could he really be dead already and no one know about it? Volodya wondered. It seemed unlikely.
"And if he's alive?"
"I don't know. But whatever happens, I'd rather be there to see it than find out later."
Listening devices did not work in moving cars, Volodya knew.
The microphone just picked up engine noise, so he was confident he could not be overheard. Nevertheless, he felt fearful as he said the unthinkable.
Could Stalin be overthrown?
His father answered irritably, I told you, I don't know. Volodya was electrified. Such a question demanded a confident negative. Anything else was a yes. His father had admitted the possibility that Stalin could be finished. Volodya's hopes rose volcanically.
Think what that could be like, he said joyously. No more purges. The labor camps will be closed. Young girls will no longer be pulled off the street to be raped by the secret police.
He half expected his father to interrupt, but Grigory just listened with half-closed eyes. Volodya went on, The stupid phrase Trotsky fascist spy will disappear from our language. Army units who find themselves outnumbered and outgunned could retreat instead of sacrificing themselves uselessly. Decisions will be made rationally by groups of intelligent men working out what's best for everyone. It's the communism you dreamed of 30 years ago.
Young fool,
his father said contemptuously. The last thing we want at this point is to lose our leader. We're at war and retreating. Our sole aim must be to defend the revolution, whatever it takes. We need Stalin now more than ever. Volodya felt as if he had been slapped. It was many years since his father had called him a fool. Was the old man right? Did the Soviet Union need Stalin? The leader had made so many disastrous decisions that Volodya did not see how the country could possibly be worse off with someone else in charge. They reached their destination. Stalin's home was conventionally called a dacha, but it was not a country cottage. A long, low building with 5 tall windows each side of a grand entrance, it stood in a pine forest and was painted dull green, as if to hide it. Hundreds of armed troops guarded the gates and the double barbed wire fence. Grigory pointed to an empty aircraft battery partly concealed by camouflage netting. I put that there, he said. The guard at the gate recognized Grigory, but nevertheless asked for their identification documents. Even though Grigory was a general and Volodya a captain in intelligence, they were both patted down for weapons. Volodya drove up to the door. There were no other cars in front of the house. We'll wait for the others, his father said. A few moments later, 3 more ZIS limousines drew up. Volodya recalled that ZIS stood for Zavod Imeni Stalina, factory called Stalin. Had the executioners arrived in cars named after their victim? They all got out. 8 middle-aged men in suits and hats, holding in their hands the future of their country. Among them, Volodya recognized Foreign Minister Molotov and Secret Police Chief Bieria.
Let's go, said Grigory.
Volodya was astonished.
I'm coming in there with you?
Grigory reached under his seat and handed Volodya a Tokarev TT-33 pistol.
Put this in your pocket, he said. If that prick Bieria tries to arrest me, you shoot the fucker.
Volodya took it gingerly. The TT-33 had no safety catch. He slipped the gun into his jacket pocket. It was about 7 inches long, and got out of the car. There were 8 rounds, he recalled, in the magazine of the gun. They all went inside. Volodya feared he would be patted down again, and his gun discovered. But there was no second check. The house was painted dark colors and poorly lit. An officer showed the group into what looked like a small dining room. Stalin sat there in an armchair. The most powerful man in the Eastern Hemisphere appeared haggard and depressed. Looking up at the group entering the room, he said,
Why have you come?
The lodger gasped. Clearly, he thought they were there either to arrest him or to execute him. There was a long pause, and Volodya realized the group had not planned what to do. How could they? Not even knowing whether Stalin was alive. But what would they do now? Shoot him? There might never be another chance. At last Molotov stepped forward.
We're asking you to come back to work, he said.
Volodya had to suppress the urge to protest. But Stalin shook his head.
Can I live up to people's hopes? Can I lead the country to victory?
Volodya was flabbergasted. Would he really refuse? Stalin added,
There may be better candidates.
He was giving them a second chance to fire him. Another member of the group spoke up, and Volodya recognized Marshal Voroshilov.
"There's none more worthy," he said.
How did that help? This was hardly the time for naked flattery. Then his father joined in, saying,
"That's right."
Were they not going to let Stalin go? How could they be so stupid? Molotov was the first to say something sensible.
"We propose to form a war cabinet called the State Defense Committee, a kind of ultra-politburo, with a very small membership and sweeping powers."
Stalin quickly interposed.
"Who will be its head?"
"You,
Comrade Stalin." Volodya wanted to shout,
"No!"
There was another long silence. At last Stalin spoke.
"Very well," he said. "Now, who else shall we have on the committee?"
Bieria stepped forward and began to propose the members. It was all over, Volodya realized, feeling dizzy with frustration and disappointment. They had lost their chance. They could have deposed a tyrant, but they had lacked the nerve. Like the children of a violent father, they feared they could not manage without him. In fact, it was worse than that, he saw with growing despondency. Perhaps Stalin really had had a breakdown. It had certainly seemed real. But he had also made a brilliant political move. All the men who might replace him were here in this room. At the moment when his catastrophically poor judgment had been exposed for all to see, he had forced his rivals to come out and beg him to be their leader again. He had drawn a line under his appalling mistake and given himself a new start. Stalin was not just back. He was stronger than ever. 11. Who would have the courage to make a public protest about what was going on at Ackelberg? Carla and Frieda had seen it with their own eyes, and they had Ilse Koenig as a witness. But now they needed an advocate. There were no elected representatives anymore. All Reichstag deputies were Nazis. There were no real journalists either, just scribbling sycophants. The judges were all Nazi appointees, subservient to the government. Carla had never before realized how much she had been protected by politicians, newspapermen, and lawyers. Without them, she saw now, the government could do anything it liked, even kill people. Who could they turn to? Frieda's admirer, Heinrich von Kessel, had a friend who was a Catholic priest. "Peter was the cleverest boy in my class," he told them, "but he wasn't the most popular. A bit upright and stiff-necked. I think he'll listen to us, though." Carla thought it was worth a try. Her Protestant pastor had been sympathetic, until the Gestapo terrified him into silence. Perhaps the same would happen again, but she did not know what else to do. Heinrich took Carla, Frieda, and Ilse to Peter's church in Schöneberg early on a Sunday morning in July. Heinrich was handsome in a black suit. The girls all wore their nurses' uniforms, symbols of trustworthiness. They entered by a side door and went into a small, dusty room with a few old chairs and a large wardrobe. They found Father Peter alone, praying. He must have heard them come in, but he remained on his knees for a minute before getting up and turning to greet them. Peter was tall and thin, with regular features and a neat haircut. He was 27, Carla calculated, if he was Heinrich's contemporary. He frowned at them, not troubling to conceal his irritation at being disturbed. "I am preparing myself for mass," he said severely. "I am pleased to see you in church, Heinrich, but you must leave now. I will see you afterward."
"This is a spiritual emergency, Peter," said Heinrich. "Sit down. We have something important to tell you."
"It could hardly be more important than mass."
"Yes, it could, Peter, believe me. In 5 minutes' time you will agree." "Very well. This is my girlfriend, Frieda Frank."
Carla was surprised. Was Frieda his girlfriend now?
Frieda said, "I had a younger brother who was born with spina bifida. Earlier this year he was transferred to a hospital at Ackelberg in Bavaria for special treatment. Shortly afterward we got a letter saying he had died of appendicitis."
She turned to Carla, who took up the tale.
"My maid had a son born brain damaged. He too was transferred to Ackelberg. The maid got an identical letter on the same day."
Peter spread his hands in a so-what gesture. "I have heard this kind of thing before. It's anti-government propaganda. The church does not interfere in politics." What rubbish that was, Carla thought. The church was up to its neck in politics, but she let it pass. My maid's son did not have an appendix, she went on. He had had it removed 2 years earlier. Please, said Peter, what does this prove? Carla felt discouraged. Peter was obviously biased against them. Heinrich said, wait, Peter, you haven't heard it all. Ilse here worked at the hospital in Achelberg. Peter looked at her expectantly.
I was raised Catholic, Father,
Ilse said. Carla had not known that.
I'm not a good Catholic, Ilse went on.
God is good, not us, my daughter, said Peter piously.
Ilse said, but I knew that what I was doing was a sin. Yet I did it, because they told me to, and I was frightened.
She began to cry.
What did you do?
I killed people. Oh, Father, will God forgive me?
The priest stared at the young nurse. He could not dismiss this as propaganda. He was looking at a soul in torment. He went pale. The others were silent. Carla held her breath.
Ilse said, the handicapped people are brought to the hospital in grey buses. They don't have special treatment. We give them an injection, and they die. Then we cremate them.
She looked up at Peter. Will I ever be forgiven for what I have done? He opened his mouth to speak. His words caught in his throat, and he coughed. At last he said quietly,
how many?
Usually 4 buses.
I mean, there are about 25 patients in a bus.
100 people.
Yes, every week.
Peter's proud composure had vanished. His face was pale grey and his mouth hung open.
100 handicapped people a week?
Yes, Father.
What sort of handicap?
All sorts, mental and physical. Some senile old people, some deformed babies, men and women, paralyzed or retarded or just helpless.
He had to keep repeating it.
And the staff of the hospital killed them all?
Ilse sobbed.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I knew it was wrong.
Carla watched Peter. His supercilious air had gone. It was a remarkable transformation. After years of hearing the prosperous Catholics of this sylvan suburb confess their little sins, he had suddenly been confronted with raw evil, and he was shocked to his core. But what would he do? Peter stood up. He took Ilse by the hands and raised her from her seat.
Come back to the church, he said. Confess to your priest. God will forgive you. This much I know.
Thank you,
she whispered.
He released her hands and looked at Heinrich.
It may not be so simple for the rest of us, he said.
Then he turned his back on them and knelt to pray again. Carla looked at Heinrich, who shrugged. They got up and left the little room, Carla with her arm around the weeping Ilse. Carla said,
we'll stay for the service. Perhaps he'll speak to us again afterward.
The 4 of them walked into the nave of the church. Ilse stopped crying and became calmer. Frieda held Heinrich's arm. They took seats among the gathering congregation, prosperous men and plump women and restless children in their best clothes. People such as these would never kill the handicapped, Carla thought, yet their government did on their behalf. How had this happened? She did not know what to expect of Father Peter. Clearly he had believed what they had told him in the end. He had wanted to dismiss them as politically motivated, but Ilse's sincerity had convinced him. He had been horrified, but he had not made any promises, except that God would forgive Ilse. Carla looked around the church. The decoration was more colorful than what she was used to in Protestant churches. There were more statues and paintings, more marble and gilding and banners and candles. Protestants and Catholics had fought wars about such trivia, she recalled. How strange it seemed, in a world where children could be murdered, that anyone should care about candles. The service began. The priests entered in their robes, Father Peter the tallest among them. Carla could not read anything in his facial expression except stern piety. She sat indifferent through the hymns and prayers. She had prayed for her father, and 2 hours later had found him cruelly beaten and dying on the floor of their home. She missed him every day. sometimes every hour. Praying had not saved him, nor would it protect those deemed useless by the government. Action was needed, not words. Thinking of her father brought her brother Eric to mind. He was somewhere in Russia. He had written a letter home, jubilantly celebrating the rapid progress of the invasion, and angrily refusing to believe that Walter had been murdered by the Gestapo. Their father had obviously been released unharmed by the Gestapo, and then attacked in the street by criminals, or communists, or Jews, he asserted. He was living in a fantasy, beyond the reach of reason. Was the same true of Father Peter? Peter mounted the pulpit. Carla had not known he was due to preach a sermon. She wondered what he would say. Would he be inspired by what he had heard this morning? Would he speak of something irrelevant, the virtue of modesty or the sin of envy? Or would he close his eyes and devoutly thank God for the German army's continuing victories in Russia? He stood tall in the pulpit and swept the church with a gaze that might have been arrogant or proud or defiant. The fifth commandment says, "Thou shalt not kill." Carla met Heinrich's eye. What was Peter going to say? His voice rang out between the echoing stones of the nave. "There is a place in Arkelberg, Bavaria, where our government is breaking the commandment 100 times a week. Carla gasped. He was doing it. He was preaching a sermon against the program. This could change everything. "It makes no difference that the victims are handicapped, or mentally ill, or incapable of feeding themselves, or paralyzed." Peter was letting his anger show. "Helpless babies and senile old people are all God's children, and their lives are as sacred as yours and mine." His voice rose in volume. "To kill them is a mortal sin." He lifted his right arm and made a fist, and his voice shook with emotion. "I say to you that if we do nothing about it, we sin just as much as the doctors and nurses who administer the lethal injections. If we remain silent," he paused, "if we remain silent, we are murderers too." 12. Inspector Thomas Markau was furious. He had been made to look a fool in the eyes of Superintendent Kringelein and the rest of his superiors. He had assured them he had plugged the leak, the secret of Arkelberg, and hospitals of the same kind in other parts of the country were safe, he had said. He had tracked down the three troublemakers, Werner Frank, Pastor Ochs, and Walter von Ulrich, and in different ways he had silenced each of them, and yet the secret had come out. The man responsible was an arrogant young priest called Peter. Father Peter was in front of Marka now, naked, strapped by wrists and ankles to a specially constructed chair. He was bleeding from the ears, nose, and mouth, and had vomit all down his chest. Electrodes were attached to his lips, his nipples, and his penis. A strap around his forehead prevented him from breaking his neck while the convulsions shook him. A doctor, sitting beside the priest, checked his heart with a stethoscope and looked dubious. "He can't stand much more," he said in a matter-of-fact tone. Father Peter's seditious sermon had been taken up elsewhere. The Bishop of Münster, a much more important clergyman, had preached a similar sermon, denouncing the T4 program. The bishop had called upon Hitler to save the people from the Gestapo, cleverly implying that the Führer could not possibly know about the program, thereby offering Hitler a ready-made alibi. His sermon had been typed out and duplicated and passed from hand to hand all over Germany. The Gestapo had arrested every person found in possession of a copy, but to no avail. It was the only time in the history of the Third Reich that there had been a public outcry against any government action. The clampdown was savage, but it did no good. The duplicates of the sermon continued to proliferate. More clergymen prayed for the handicapped, and there was even a protest march in Arkelberg. It was out of control, and Marker was to blame. He bent over Peter. The priest's eyes were closed and his breathing was shallow, but he was conscious. Marker shouted in his ear, "Who told you about Arkelberg?" There was no reply. Peter was Marker's only lead. Investigations in the town of Achelberg had turned up nothing of significance. Reinhold Wagner had been told a story about two girl cyclists who had visited the hospital, but no one knew who they were, and another story about a nurse who had resigned suddenly, writing a letter saying she was getting married in haste, but not revealing who the husband was. Neither clue led anywhere. In any case, Marker felt sure this calamity could not be the work of a gaggle of girls. Marker nodded to the technician operating the machine. He turned a knob. Peter screamed in agony as the electrical current coursed through his body, torturing his nerves. He shook as if in a fit, and the hair on his head stood up. The operator turned the current off. Marker screamed, "Give me his name!" At last, Peter opened his mouth. Marker leaned closer. Peter whispered,
"No, man."
"A woman, then? Give me the name."
"It was an angel."
"Damn you to hell."
Marker seized the knob and turned it.
"This goes on until you tell me," he yelled,
as Peter shuddered and screamed. The door opened. A young detective looked in, turned pale and beckoned to Marker. The technician turned the current off, and the screaming stopped. The doctor leaned forward to check Peter's heart. The detective said, "Excuse me, Inspector Marker, but you're wanted by Superintendent Kringelein."
"Now?"
said Marker irritably. "That's what he said, sir." Marker looked at the doctor, who shrugged. "He's young," he said. "He'll be alive when you get back." Marker left the room and went upstairs with the detective. Kringelein's office was on the first floor. Marker knocked and went in.
"The damn priest hasn't talked yet," he said without preamble. "I need more time."
Kringelein was a slight man with spectacles, clever but weak-willed. A late convert to Nazism, he was not a member of the elite SS. He lacked the fervor of enthusiasts such as Marker.
"Don't bother any further with that priest," he said. "We're no longer interested in any of the clergymen. Throw them in camps and forget them."
Marker could not believe his ears.
"But these people have conspired to undermine the Führer."
"And they have succeeded," said Kringelein, "whereas you have failed." Marker suspected that Kringelein was privately pleased about this.
"A decision has been made at the top," the superintendent went on. "Aktion T4 has been cancelled."
Marker was flabbergasted. The Nazis never allowed their decisions to be swayed by the misgivings of the ignorant.
"We didn't get where we are by kowtowing to public opinion," he said.
"We have this time."
"Why?"
"The Führer neglected to explain his decision to me personally," Kringelein said sarcastically, "but I can guess. The program has attracted remarkably angry protests from a normally passive public. If we persist with it, we risk an open confrontation with churches of all denominations. That would be a bad thing. We must not weaken the unity and determination of the German people, particularly right now, when we are at war with the Soviet Union, our strongest enemy yet. So the program is cancelled."
"Very good, sir," said Marker, controlling his anger. "Will there be anything else?"
"Dismissed," said Kringelein. Marker went to the door. "Marker?"
He turned.
"Yes, sir."
"Change your shirt."
"My shirt?"
"There's blood on it."
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
Marker stamped down the stairs, boiling. He returned to the basement chamber. Father Peter was still alive. Raging, he yelled again,
"Who told you about Achelberg?"
There was no reply. He turned the current up to maximum. Father Peter screamed for a long time. Then, at last, he fell into a final silence. 13. The villa where the Frank family lived was set in a small park. 200 yards from the house, on a slight rise, was a little pagoda, open on all sides, with seats. As children, Carla and Frida had pretended it was their country house, and had played for hours pretending to have grand parties, where dozens of servants waited on their glamorous guests. Later it became their favorite place to sit and talk, where no one could hear them.
"The first time I sat on this bench, my feet didn't reach the floor," Carla said.
Frida said,
"I wish we could go back to those days."
It was a sultry afternoon, overcast and humid, and they both wore sleeveless dresses. They were in a somber mood. Father Peter was dead. He had committed suicide in custody, having become depressed about his crimes, according to the police. Carla wondered if he had been beaten as her father had. It seemed dreadfully likely. There were dozens more in police cells all over Germany. Some had protested publicly about the killing of the handicapped. Others had done no more than pass round copies of Bishop von Galen's sermon. She wondered if all of them would be tortured. She wondered how long she would escape such a fate. Werner came out of the house with a tray. He carried it across the lawn to the pagoda. Cheerily he said, "How about some lemonade, girls?" Carla looked away. "No, thank you," she said coldly. She did not understand how he could pretend to be her friend after the cowardice he had shown. Frieda said, "Not for me." "I hope we're still friends," Werner said, looking at Carla. How could he say such a thing? Of course they were not friends. Frieda said, "Father Peter is dead, Werner." Carla added, "Probably tortured to death by the Gestapo, because he refused to accept the murder of people such as your brother. My father is dead too, for the same reason. Lots of other people are in jail or in camps. But you kept your cushy desk job, so that's all right." Werner looked hurt. That surprised Carla. She had expected defiance, or at least an effort at insouciance. But he seemed genuinely upset. He said, "Don't you think we each have our different ways of doing what we can?" This was feeble. "You did nothing," Carla said. "Perhaps," he said sadly. "No lemonade, then?" Neither girl answered, and he went back to the house. Carla was indignant and angry, but she could not help also feeling regret. Before she discovered that Werner was a coward, she had been embarking on a romance with him. She had liked him a lot, 10 times more than any other boy she had kissed. She was not quite heartbroken, but she was deeply disappointed. Frieda was luckier. This thought was prompted by the sight of Heinrich coming out of the house. Frieda was glamorous and fun-loving, and Heinrich was brooding and intense, but somehow they made a good pair. "Are you in love with him?" Carla said while he was still out of earshot.
"I don't know yet," Frieda replied. "He's terribly sweet, though. I kind of adore him."
That might not be love, Carla thought, but it was well on the way. Heinrich was bursting with news.
"I had to come and tell you right away," he said. "My father told me after lunch."
"What?"
said Frieda. "The government has cancelled the project. It was called Aktion T4, the killing of the handicapped. They're stopping."
Carla said, "You mean we won?" Heinrich nodded vigorously.
"My father is amazed. He says he has never known the Führer to give in to public opinion before."
Frieda said,
"And we forced him to?"
"Thank God no one knows that," Heinrich said fervently. Carla said, "They're just going to close the hospitals and end the whole program?"
"Not exactly."
"What do you mean?"
"My father says all those doctors and nurses are being transferred."
Carla frowned.
"Where?"
"To Russia," said Heinrich.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of